Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Tuesday, August 9th. Amanda Borchel Dunn here with our political correspondent, Carrie Keller-Lynn, and health reporter, Nathan Jeff A. Hello to you both.
Good morning.
Hi, Amanda.
We will discuss whether current Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reaped any political dividends from his direction of Operation Breaking Dawn. We'll hear about the Labour primaries today and catch up with Nathan's work on fascinating new scientific research on precision viruses and more. Carrie, let's begin with you. Lapid took the podium last night to deliver a State of the Union following the 66-hour military operation, and he basically addressed the Palestinian people directly. What was his message to them?
So I think that was the most interesting part of his statement last night. The rest of it, obviously, was very conciliatory, thanking everyone else involved in the mission, including Egyptian mediators. And what Lapid said to Gazans, directly to Gazan residents, not to Hamas leadership, was, "There is another way." He suggested that Israel could be a partner in providing work in means of livelihood, creating dignity, adding to an innovation-led economy, regional development, joint projects, much of like a vision envisioned by the Abraham Accords, and told Gazan residents, the choice is yours. And this is especially interesting given that we're seeing on Arab social media, much in the last few days, actual dissatisfaction with the last operation, rather than kind of support and just a unified voice against Israel. There was a lot of criticism for Islamic Jihad, especially because a lot of misfired rockets landed in Gaza and were well documented by Gazan residents. And so this is very interesting, the timing of Lapid's statement. It might actually be a change of direction where he's directly appealing to Gazan residents and saying, the choice is yours.
You also wrote a great analysis on Lapid's political dividends in Israel, those who vote for him. I just want to quote the first sentence, which I thought was brilliant. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but can it be worth Knesset seats? You're, of course, referring to the picture of Lapid with former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Tell us more about this.
So that picture is kind of a synecdoche for this larger political narrative brewing between Netanyahu and Lapid. Lapid is a rare prime minister who does not have serious security chops. He didn't serve in a combat unit. He hasn't really had any security roles before becoming prime minister, other than serving in the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee as a member of Knesset. Netanyahu, on the other hand, has really painted himself as security. His old campaign slogan was Bibi Bitachon. Bibi is security. Netanyahu is security. And this last operation was very limited in scope, but sort of started going away towards checking that box for Lapid, saying, you know, I could lead a military operation. And that picture was kind of symbolic of Netanyahu coming to the table and getting a briefing from Lapid, something that he refused to do over the past year of this coalition government that did not include him. He got a security briefing as opposition leader from a different prime minister. Of course, Netanyahu afterwards said, you know, I shared some wisdom from my experience, but he did come out and actually say, you know, I bless this government. I congratulate this government on doing a good job, which is really, really remarkable after Netanyahu spent a year attacking Lapid's security credentials. That being said, will this actually translate into votes? No, we don't think so. Why? Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, security in Israel is a necessary but not sufficient condition to be prime minister. You need to be good at security, but being good at security alone is not going to necessarily drive voters because it's table stakes. And Lapid's problem in this election is going to be in terms of the way that his potential bloc is formed. So Lapid is a center-left leader. He needs to have enough seats on his center-left side to cross that majority 61 threshold and hold on to the prime ministership he currently has in caretaker status. However, this operation, this limited operation, does not create a track record for him, and it does not overcome ideological barriers that right-wing voters have to him. He is very unlikely to draw voters across those lines. In fact, the first surveys came out last night and showed exactly that. There's been no real movement for him in terms of growing his bloc, despite the fact that overwhelmingly positive. I think 68% of Israeli voters said that they really did approve of the way he handled this last mission, this last operation.
Okay, so let's talk about one of Lapid's natural partners, the Labor Party. They're going into primaries. What do you expect to see here? Any kind of earthquake, any kind of shifts?
I think we expect to see a very polite, digitally run primary contest with a early answer, even this evening as primaries happen today. They close at 7 p.m. Israel. I think we'll have an answer within the hour afterwards. And sources from within the party have consistently told me that they expect the list to look quite similar to the current Knesset list. That being said, Labor has not conducted extensive polling. These are all kind of feelings from field events and knowing activists. And also the party is currently polling at 5 to 6 seats in the Knesset. It has 7 at the moment. It's in the government, which means it was able to bump some 3 folks into ministers and take on some more Knesset members. But given the fact that it's going to be hard for Labor to find its way into the next coalition, it might be capped at the number of seats it wins. So the list of politicians who are currently in power with Labor might shrink, and this race thus might be very tight for a small number of seats.
Talking about a small number, I was a little shocked to see how few members are actually voting today. How many will be voting?
Actually, Labor is quite proud of how it grew, but 40,000 people are registered in the party and eligible to vote. This has increased by 5,000 since the government fell last 5 weeks. So Labor is quite proud of that. Of course, this is nothing like the Labor heyday, where it was one of the largest parties in Israel. And I believe in the early 90s, it still had over 100,000 registered members. So this is definitely still part of the Labor rebuild stage that its leader, Mirav Mikhaeli, has envisioned.
Okay, Carrie, thanks for that. We'll go to a short break now.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jewish Quarterly is the leading international journal of ideas and culture. In the August issue, Kim Gattis investigates Iran's 43-year quest to dominate the Middle East. Aryeh Dubnov casts light on Israel's first native Hebrew speaker. William Miles reports on the Jews of the West Indies, plus features on the Ukraine pogroms, the Sassoon dynasty, and Hannah Arendt. Jewish Quarterly, out now at good booksellers worldwide or subscribe at jewishquarterly.com. And we're back. Carrie, before you head off, I know you have a busy day. Tell us about the trip you took to Ashkelon on Sunday while the rockets were still raining down during Operation Breaking Dawn.
Yeah, and the morning before the ceasefire took effect, before we knew there would be a ceasefire, I drove down because I learned that 25% of the residents in Ashkelon, a city that's only 7 miles from the northern Gaza border, a mid-sized city of 150,000 people, which is quite sizable in Israel, 25% of them do not have access to adequate shelter, which is absolutely mind-boggling in a town that absorbed over 1,000 rockets in last May's operation and over 100 this time. And to just kind of set the scene of how stressful it is, there's kind of a way that you drive when there are rockets on the forecast. You have the radio on, you have the windows down. And as I was kind of pulling into this community, a siren went off, an air raid siren, and I immediately had to ditch the car And I kind of experienced what one of these community members experienced. I looked for a building, I ran into the first one, and I just saw a bunch of people crowded in a completely open, exposed, very short, narrow stairwell. Something that you would be horrified to think was an actual shelter. These buildings were built before Hamas launched its first rocket towards Israel. And they had very open lobbies, no doors, very broad, perfect for, you know, shrapnel to find its way in and strike someone. And through this process, you know, I met a lot of folks who actually just kind of gave up on their homes for this period and moved into municipal shelters. You'd see these families, you'd walk around the street, you'd see these large kind of concrete boxes, and you'd poke your head inside and you'd walk down, and there's this whole underground world of families who've just moved into municipal shelters because they don't have protections in their homes. They don't have protected rooms. They don't have protected staircases even, let alone shelters in their buildings. And there's no realistic way to get from a fourth floor apartment to the municipal shelter that's a minute down the street with your four kids in under 15 seconds.
Listeners, I will put a link in our program notes with the piece that Carrie wrote on Sunday. Carrie, thank you for that. Nathan, thanks for your patience. Now, during Operation Breaking Dawn, you highlighted the newly rocket-proofed hospital at the Adi Negev Nahalat Iran Rehabilitation Village, quite a mouthful, that is located just 40 kilometers from the Gaza border. Tell us about this new rocket-proofed hospital.
Yeah, so one of the rather tragic parts of the Gaza-Israel story is the extent to which the mindset of living under rocket fire sporadically has to enter everything, including kind of building expectations and regulations. Carrie was talking about where bomb shelters are lacking. In all new building, there is a very strong push to make things rocket-proof. And when they were building Israel's newest rehabilitation hospital in the Negev, it was very clear to those building it that it had to be built with a very high degree of protection, but in a specific way. Not in the sense that, hey, when there's rockets, you have to start moving everybody every time there's an alarm and, you know, there's the ability to make people safe, but rather that normal life should continue as much as possible in the hospital. And also that time spent sheltering from rockets ideally shouldn't be in an underground bunker, lacking natural light and all that kind of thing. So at the Adi Negev Nahalat Iran Rehabilitation Village, the new hospital has been taking patients for just 3 weeks, and already its defenses, its kind of setup for when crisis strikes was put to the test. As it happened, such a large area of the hospital, about two-thirds of the hospital, is protected against rockets. These are areas with natural light, with windows, not underground. And the staff were really moved by the smoothness with which they were able to do things, that they didn't need to reorganize, that people could stay put. And they saw it as kind of, you know, a really big success of their design. So that was very heartwarming to report on that this week.
Now, this next story we're going to discuss is very near to my heart, as one of my dear cousins has suffered from Crohn's disease for decades. You recently wrote about Israeli scientists who are working to develop, quote, precision weapons against bowel disorders consisting of viruses that fight bacteria, including Crohn's disease. Tell us more about this.
What's happened here is that scientists in Israel have developed a virus which they believe actually fights bacteria that are in our guts, bacteria that seem to be very prevalent in people with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. So what they've done is they've developed these viruses that actually counter the bacteria that seem to cause a lot of suffering in people with these conditions. If readers take a look at the article on this, they'll see what this type of viruses look like, these bacteria-fighting viruses look like. And they do look kind of, as you'd imagine them, almost kind of robot-form viruses. So they look really cool. And what the scientists here have done is they've actually, at the Weizmann Institute of Science, they've come up with cocktails of different viruses that seem to have great promise in fighting these gut bacteria that seem to be the bane of the lives of people with ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's. It's important to say here that the idea of viruses that fight bacteria is by no means a new one. This is an idea that was explored a lot in the early 20th century, but the research didn't really advance because of antibiotics, because antibiotics came along and everyone says, antibiotics are the answer to all of our problems. But what we have today is lots of concern in the medical community about antibiotic resistance. And these viruses, these bacteria-fighting viruses, which have been used in research contexts, just haven't been really advanced as medical solutions, these are seen as kind of, you know, quite hopeful for the era of antibiotic resistance as a kind of parallel track for fighting bacteria.
Okay, now if that research was bordering on science fiction, this next story is definitely already there. An Israeli lab has grown synthetic mouse embryos with brains and beating hearts in an egg-free, sperm-free procedure that used stem cells taken from skin. I don't think anyone could even imagine that as being real. Tell us about that.
It seems that fertility research is a bit like buses, kind of you wait ages for it and then you get two or three that come along at once, because I've had several remarkable stories on all different fertility innovations in the last couple of weeks. And what's happening in this story, which is actually by coincidence another Weizmann Institute story, peer-reviewed research, which means that it's been kind of very closely examined by the scientific community. And what they actually managed to do was to take stem cells from skin and, using these stem cells from skin, create mouse embryos. No egg, no sperm, just stem cells. And at the center of this innovation, of this advance, is this technology that has been developed at Weizmann that can be used for growing embryos. It's all in the kind of environment that they're using. Why is this important? Not because it is seen as a solution to people or animals facing fertility difficulties. That's not what this is about. This is about the possibility of growing embryos that don't come from a sperm and an egg, potentially to provide cells that could be useful for transplants and for solving health problems in the future. There's a lot of ethical issues that come up with even discussing the idea of using actual regular embryos for such things. That's kind of an ethical minefield. But if you're growing kind of partly developed embryos from skin cells, that's seen as a very different set of questions. And that's why the researchers behind this are so excited about it.
So essentially, if God forbid you were severely burned and you needed some skin, you would take a cell from your own skin and create new skin for yourself. Is this one of the possible effects?
Yeah, these are the types of things that we're looking at. So kind of things that could, and I stress to listeners that this is all very, very theoretical. Anything that happened with this would go through numerous ethical committees. So there's kind of nothing happening here beyond the kind of theoretical research at this point. But yeah, these are the ideas that it could provide this set of very interesting solutions.
Really fascinating, Nathan. I look forward to hearing much more about this and other research on our most amazing mice that we have here in Israel.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for joining me today. And listeners, have a great day.
Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.